All right. Let's talk about pricing your cards at card shows, because when I go to a card show, David, and I see a lot of people say this, they will walk right by tables that don't have prices on them, especially a busy table. Now you got to ask the guy, like, so my rule and advice I've been giving for years to people going to card shows is to people setting up a card shows, if you want to have a good show, a better show than you otherwise would, put prices on your cards and put them on the front of your cards, because that is going to, my first couple shows, prices on the back. Maybe I was embarrassed of my prices. Then I'm like, no, prices on the front. And ever since I've done that, I've never had a bad show. So I'm in the price your cards, put them on the front of the cards, let the attendees see the prices. That will be good for your show, especially if you're busy. If all you're selling is dust, then fine. You know, you can take time to tell people your prices because no one's at your booth anyway. But if you want to have a busy show, I think you should price your cards. David, your thoughts, please.
So I think pricing your cards is a best practice, and it helps demonstrate a willingness to actually sell. And, you know, when I'm at the show set up as a dealer, I want to sell things. I paid for a table space. I'm not just there to buy cards. I'm there to sell cards. So, you know, I'm calling it a best practice because I have done it both ways, and I have not necessarily experienced a difference in success or not. But you know, it does help me at least to know I put that price on there. Now, you know, for some people, I let's address the people who say they're walking by. First of all, if you're at a show and you're walking by a table and they don't have prices and you're telling us that, you know, you're just going to walk by, the first thing I'm going to say to you is then that really just may mean there's not anything in there that you wanted, because I know better. If there was a card in that case and it didn't have a price on it, but it was a card you wanted, you darn well would stop and wait and ask for a price, and you'd be on your phone looking up the comp to see what it is that I was going to say about it. And so I also think, and this is actually from my experience, the people that are often walking by because somebody don't have prices on there, more often than not, they're the bargain hunters anyway, right? That they're not necessarily looking to collect all these cards out of my case that haven't been priced. They're bargain hunting. Maybe they're looking to speculate. Maybe they're looking to invest. And listen, if that's the case, I completely hear the idea that, like, your time is valuable. Time is money in those shows. You need to be able to keep moving. But let's not pretend to call that's the collecting aspect, and somehow by not pricing my cards, I've impeded your ability to do that. That's ridiculous. We're all smarter than that. Don't talk about it that way. Let's just call it what it is, right? I'm looking to speculate. I'm looking to invest. I'm looking for bargains. I'm looking for deals. Cool. You absolutely, listen, Jeremy, that's all I do at card shows is I'm looking for that stuff. And then I try my very best to price my cards. But you know, one of the things that I think we could both somewhat attest to is it is rare, very rare, that someone just pays the price that I have in a card, even if I've priced it right. I mean, certainly right now at the shows I've been at, the comp conversation is just paralyzing people. So even when you price it comp, most people I know are not wanting to pay it. And part of it's a psychological thing. There's a haggle culture that exists. It shows where, most people want to feel like they got a deal. And so sometimes, you know, at least I know this is what I've done. I've tried to adapt to that and sometimes move my prices around, you know, within, I call it like a 10 to 15%, type of range. You absolutely can put a price on a card that's also just too high. And so it, you know, you've kind of got to find that balance. But, you know, I haven't experienced much. Even when I price competitively, the people will pay it. They always end up asking me for something less. And as we're talking about the psychological element, it's not just from the buyer's standpoint, it's from the seller's too. I'm there set up, I want to sell. And if I've priced competitively and I keep getting hit with, well, would you take less? Would you take less? Would you take less? Like, I don't want to be saying no all the time, or I don't want to have to always just hold firm at my price, right? I want to transact, but I also want to get in a conversation. And I think some people would tell you that knowing the proliferation of the availability of the online price data, right? Not pricing your cards when someone then asks you about it, it's the easiest way to invite the conversation to see if you can't do the haggle negotiation into the range of something that makes sense so you can close the deal. Like I tell people all the time, I don't like letting deals die over 5%. Like, to me, once you've kind of gotten into that range, that you've got to find a way to finish it. But you don't want to always be the person that's giving away the 5% either. But, you know, look, having prices on the cards sort of helps indicate, I believe, to people what your willingness to sell and probably does give a hint of your willingness and or ability to negotiate on certain cards. And so I do understand that I think that is helpful to people on the buyer's side of the table, and which is why I think I like to call it a best practice.
Yeah. No, lots of great comments there. So I have a few sort of thoughts that came through what you were saying. So if I'm at the show shopping, I'm walking around and my time is of the essence, you know, I'm going to be looking in showcases. If the dealer is busy, there's a card I like, but there's a good chance that someone else has that card and there's no price on it there, I'm not going to stop and ask him. If he would have put a price on it, he might have had my sale. But because there might not be a price, and I feel like I can get another copy of it somewhere else, it's not going to be that much different or anything, that guy's maybe just lost the sale to me. So that's one situation. It depends on the card. Like if it's a card that you think you can get again, fine. But like you said, if it's a card that I really want and you have in your showcase and there's no price on it, 100% I'm going to wait, or I'll come back and I'm going to ask you about that card. But what having a price on it does for me is it lets me know if you're within the realm, because I believe there is still some of this post-COVID pricing hangover from some dealers who don't want to sell cards for today's values. And
for sure,
I don't hold that against them, but I don't want to wait 10 minutes for you to finish two other deals to only find out that the card I want to pay $150 for, you're asking $500 for because you bought it in 2021. And I just wasted 15 minutes of my precious time at the show. Yeah. In defense of not pricing your cards, though, some vendors don't have time. Like prices change so fast in this hobby on so many cards that, you know, if you have a family, you have a full-time job, and you're just a part-time dealer who sets up a card shows like you and I, well, like I do and many vendors do, sometimes the time gets away from you and you don't have time to price them. And that's happened to me before. In that case, I'm at the show, my cards are in there unpriced. I feel a little sheepish, but to people asking, I'm like, guys, I just didn't have time this month to price my cards. But if there's anything you're like, I will say that a million times.
Me too.
During the weekend, because I don't want people to be scared that they think that my prices are going to be high, because that's the assumption on a lot of people when you don't have prices on your cards.
And do you ever notice that when you've priced your entire case, except for like three cards, the cards that everyone asks you the most about are the three that don't have prices. And it's not because they want them. It's like OCD. Yeah. They can't stand that they don't know how much that one is, even though they're no interest in buying it.
Right.
wanted to know. And you're right. Like, but why?
Why isn't that one? Why isn't that one priced?
I'm telling you, people had kind of laughed at me when I described this psychological element, but I mean, I'm just telling you guys, it's true. And it does, you mentioned it. It takes a lot of time to price your cards. For those of you out there that are kind of righteously indignant to those of us when we don't do it, my challenge to you is, if you've never set up at a show and had to do it yourself, quite frankly, you don't know how hard it is and how much time it takes, because it doesn't take an hour when you have three cards in your case, especially as in instances where prices are really moving around.
Yeah.
I mean, it's dozens of hours of time to prep to be ready before it. And I mean, listen, with some of the modern stuff, Jeremy, prices move in an instant. I mean, when we were up in Chicago, Joe Burrow's fluctuated 40% in price over the span of like 30 minutes when people were speculating that maybe he'd torn an ACL versus just pulling a calf muscle. I mean, there was a collective groan in my section of the show when that news sort of hit the wire, and some people were like immediately trying to hit eject on some of their cards. So
I see people sometimes saying that I've seen people put out there that not pricing your cards is sheer laziness. It's all it is being lazy. But that, if you're saying that, you must not have much to do with your time, because a lot of people have a lot going on in their lives, and it's not laziness. It's literally running out of time. You still need to sleep. So I think, you know, don't project so much your lifestyle on other people sometimes if you're thinking that way. Some people just don't have time. But, you know, and you can say, well, price a month early. Yeah, but these prices move.
Guys, it's just not that easy. And then when you consider you're traveling for shows, so there's another dead day in there. I mean, it is an effort for me every time I do it, even when I'm setting up here in my home city. It's still hard.
Stukes here says, the worst thing at a card show is waiting for a dealer to look up comps. Had to do that in an LCS the other day. Yeah, it is. I don't know if it's the worst thing at a card show, Stukes, but it's definitely a frustrating thing for sure. LGC says, what do you think about dealers that like to flex at shows and put cards in their displays that are not for sale? So I see a lot of people like saying, if it's in the showcase, it's for sale, you know, or something like that. Or why would you put it? Like, first of all, you know, sometimes there are marketing reasons for putting certain cards in there to let people know that you play in this area. Or like, I don't, if you put a card in your showcase and I ask you about it and you say it's not for sale, I don't get bent out of shape. I say, oh, cool. So now I know what you like. Like, I don't care. Honestly, I don't care when people do that. I've done it before in the past. I once brought a whole showcase just to show a set of cards that I'd collected because I thought people would find it interesting. And I know a couple people that it totally influenced the way they collect. And this is back in like, this is over 10 years ago. These were one of one jumbo, the first mega patches ever made came out in the game product. In any event, I don't hold it against anybody. Tyler Teapot says, I really dislike it when there are no prices. I'll wait to speak with the dealer only to find that he's way over fair market value, wasted time. Now, that's not always going to be the case, but that is often going to be the case, and that is frustrating. But there's a comment down here from Sean Red who says, Jeremy, I bought a big card from a guy who never changed his COVID prices but came down 60% from his sticker. And then I stopped by your booth and showed it to you. I vaguely remember, Sean, somebody showing me a card and telling me that story. It must have been you. What card was it? Because I can't remember exactly. But kudos to that dealer for being realistic, right?
Yeah, look, it goes back to my discussion point, right? I mean, because I'm with Tyler on that at some level. It's really disappointing when you ask someone and they're way over market. But and I'm a little bit... People see me online and think I'm a lot more extroverted than I really am in person. I'm not always the person that'll engage the discussion when I really should. And, you know, so my counter to that would be, look, if it's overpriced, maybe you just ask the question, you know, of am I missing something? Because these are the kind of comps that I'm seeing. Is that a range you think you could be in? And most dealers, once I sort of realize that I'm mispriced, then I, you know, I've got to make the call. Am I willing to get rid of the card in that price or not? And if I'm not, I say no, and the frustration remains. But more times than not, if it is in my case, it's available for sale, and I understand that I need to be at kind of fair market value to sell. So questions, if you can enter the discussion, I really think that that helps facilitate the commerce, because it gets beyond just this dollar value concept.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. Currency Project says, where can we find the full Peter Forsberg interview? It's on my YouTube channel, Currency Project. You can find it, the full 9 or 10 minute video, on the channel. Diamond Dog says, the hair contrast between Jamie and David is mega. David has mega hair. Jeremy has, no hair. Lash Wine says, updating prices is quite time consuming for sure. 1956 Tops Guy says, I care less about non-pricing and a lot more about people starting 40% high. That's fair.
Yeah.
And the Card Man says, we only have a handful of shows a year here in Sydney. My brain couldn't cope with having to reprice more than that. Yeah, for sure. Sean, the Gretzky grade at 8. Yeah, I do recall that. Congratulations on your purchase. I mean, yeah, congratulations on adding a nice Gretzky to the collection. Matthew says, the markup is either wasting everyone's time or a tax on the newbie. Neither is good for the hobby and is antiquated. Ideally, the market removes those dealers. Yeah, that would be what we'd hope, right, Matthew? But some of these guys keep on coming back. They're the guys sitting at their booths, reading the newspaper and not even looking up at you when you come by the booth a lot of the time. And I don't know why they bother going. It must be their one outing of the year. But hey. All right. That was the topic on pricing your cards. Let's talk about hobby truths. David, you've put out a few hobby truths on your Instagram stories lately. And one of them actually sort of segues in from what we were just talking about as far as the lazy factor of not pricing cards, which I think we agree in some cases for some vendors, they are just being lazy by not pricing their cards because they probably do have the time on their hands. But speaking for myself and some other people that I know, and I do find the time, but I can understand that some people might not. You know, I will stay up till 4 a.m. to get it done, but I might lose sleep and my wife might not be happy with me, but you know, I make the sacrifice. But David, talk about your hobby truths, please. What are we getting at here?
All right. So I have really only two hobby truths. I believe that there are only two hobby truths, and nearly anything and everything we talk about can fall into one or the other. And they're as simple as this. Hobby truth number one, the hobby is lazy. It's just true, and I'll talk about why that is.
Okay.
My second hobby truth is the hobby is stupid, and it does and it says stupid things. And we spent an hour talking about that earlier tonight, a very, very, very stupid thing. So back to the lazy. Look, I'll pose it to you this way. How many auction houses are out there?
100.
Easily, right? And there's 30 to 40 you and I could rattle off if right now, just off the top of our heads, if we wanted to, right? Well, that also means, Jeremy, that there are 100 logins and 100 passwords and at least 100 items on an auction calendar. And like, quite honestly, it's super ridiculous. So in some ways, like, it may not just be lazy, it just may be completely overwhelming. But at the same time, as collectors, we also like to gripe about, well, how did I miss that card, right? And the answer is, it's actually easy to miss it with all that stuff going on. But if you wanted to devote the time and effort to get through all these things, you probably could, right? And so we naturally, when we're not interested or we may be overwhelmed, it's kind of tough to push through all that. And so we end up being lazy. We skip things. We take auction nights off, or we don't go to the show, or some of us just don't price the cards because we're jerks and it takes too much time. We didn't run out of time. We just wanted to spend time drinking beer and eating nachos. Like, I mean, things happen, but we buy cards that we shouldn't because we actually already own it and we forgot. I do this all the time. Forgot the list, and so that I actually remember out of the 5,000 cards or more that I own that already have that thing. I mean, these things happen, and so you know, not undifferent, not really different than in your regular life. You know, trying to find ways to, you know, eliminate some of your laziness, try to identify ways to that work for you to be organized, to be intentional. You know, those are the types of efforts that I think they not only benefit you in your hobby, in your hobby world, in your collecting, but can also benefit you in life. And then, well, I'll let you jump in on that.
I appreciate, because listen, what I'm going to say is that what you just added so much to your Instagram. When I saw your Instagram post talking about these hobby truths, I didn't know that's what you meant. So I now realize that I can't just take, in every case, I can't just take I can't take what you're putting on your Instagram story at face value. I need to ask more questions and dive deeper, or I have to ask and encourage you to be more explanatory about what you're thinking behind your comment. Because your comment on Instagram, when you posted these the other day, I had no idea that there was so much depth to it. So yeah. I would ask you as somebody who follows you to even, it's funny because Titty Subs right here says, hobby truth, David will post a minimum of 100 words on his stories 10 times a day. And I'm saying, I don't even think that's enough. I say up that a little bit so that we can get a fuller understanding of what's going on in your mind. At least for me, and maybe it was only one or two cases, but thank you. I'm glad we're here today and you could expound upon those.
Matt's the king of the TLDR. Congratulations. I'm sorry. DM to me about my Instagram story.
Right. No, I think that's fine. Diamond Dog Sports here says collectors are lazy and stupid.
True.
Yeah. I mean, some are, you know, I am always so impressed by these hardcore bargain hunters who are checking out every auction house looking for the deals, right? And then they're stocking their national booths with these deals and bringing them to the masses. Like, I just, number one, I'm not gonna say I don't have the time. I'm just not interested. I will get bored searching auction houses over and over and over again. Like, I just can't, it's not for me. I would rather pay more and have my time to, you know, work out, spend time with my wife and kids, watch some TV, have just total brain dead time a little bit here and there to recharge. So I hear you. I appreciate it. Anything else you want to talk about hobby truths wise?
I do want to touch on the stupid for a minute just to make sure, because I appreciate that there are people. It's funny, whenever I sort of post that stuff, I almost inevitably always lose a couple followers. But I told Bill this the other day. I'm like, listen, I just told everybody they're lazy and they're stupid. What's the over-under on followers I'm about to lose? But crazy enough, Jeremy, this time when I did it, I ended up positive. So I'm not sure how that happened. But look, on the stupid front, where I really want to hit this a little is in the pricing realm. So, you know, especially in the social media world, like, it's always about the record, right? And the highest paid for this and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, listen, I just want to caution people a little bit, because going back to the comps thing, right? Every time we get a price that sort of beneficially can be extended to some other card, even if it's not the same card, because like right now, we're hearing this very much, I think, about this Baltimore News Ruth that's about to sell. And Rick Probstein, among others, had suggested that that's going to ultimately drive up the prices of other Babe Ruths. similarly to what happened with the Mantles. And I see those as distinctly different cases. Like a 52 Mantle high grade selling for a bigger number, having sort of a trickle down to the lower graded ones, makes a little bit of sense because it actually is the same card. In this instance, that Baltimore News Ruth, the way I've heard a couple people describe it, they've called it a unicorn. And I think that that's 100% accurate. And that Baltimore News Ruth doesn't have anything in common whatsoever with the 33 Gaudi Ruths. It doesn't. Those are not even in the same stratosphere of the same type of card. They're just not. And so trying to extend that rationale, I think, is really dangerous. And look, the other thing is too, we were talking about mega bids, right? Mega bids in many instances are stupid bids because it's one person, or as we've seen, maybe a couple that are really willing to just go all in on something because they just got to own it, right? But if you are sort of a student of that next level of bidding history, which is what I've tried to really be more about some of the cards I'm targeting, is understanding what the market really looks like there. And if I can't, for all the cards I want to collect, if I just keep making decisions based on people that are really probably overpaying for something outside of a historical range, there's something else potentially going on with them that wouldn't necessarily be going on with me. And that, so again, it gets back to the research part, which falls back into my lazy bit. You've got to be able to do that. And again, find your comfort zone so that you don't act emotionally necessarily in a moment and kind of, you know, do something from a bid or an overpay standpoint that you wouldn't if you'd really done your preparation better. And so, right. You know, well, I just think that's key to when I talk about people doing stupid stuff, like I think definitely in the prices paid for certain things, it really does happen more often than we think. And there's always often something deeper to it that you won't be able to really identify just by looking at bid histories and price comparison. So
I'd like to carve out an exclusion from that mega bid comment you made, saying like, you know, somebody going all in on something. So it really depends on the type of the card. If we're talking about a liquid commodity type, like you're talking about a Jordan rookie or a Gretzky rookie or whatever, a common card, yeah, there's no need to put in a mega bid. There will be another copy that will be just as good then that can come along. But the exclusion to me is when you are pitting the set collector against the player collector, and the card is extremely limited, even just a one of one. And I'm only speaking from experience. When I went against I was a set collector going against player collectors, and I put in a bid that was easily six times what this card should reasonably sell for, but I needed the card. So, but I wanted the card badly. The other thing is with respect to the Babe Ruth. So you're saying that the 1914 Baltimore News, well, it's a different category of card from other Ruth cards, so it's not going to drag up the values of those other cards. Now, I have a counterpoint to that, which is REA has been on, they've been on like CNN, I think, with this card. No, CNN, they've been on some big news outlets, and it is going to bring attention to Babe Ruth cards. So what I say to your comment is, I think that there is going to be the potential short-term bump on other Babe Ruth cards, because there's going to be eyeballs on the hobby from people that aren't always looking, people with money who might say, oh my God, this Babe Ruth card just sold for $12 million. What other Babe Ruth card can I buy? Let's go check eBay. Let's check the auction. Now, let's find out where the auctions are. Let's go look. And maybe I'll buy a different card because it's in my peripheral now. I'm aware of it. It's just marketing for all. It's marketing for other Babe Ruth cards. But it's different. We're talking about you are speaking to the informed. You are speaking about the informed hobbyist. They're not going to, that will not change the value of the 33 Gaudis or any other base. I agree with you 100%.
It shouldn't.
Long term. But short term, it might have an impact because of the marketing value of this 1914 Babe Ruth card by REA. But I do believe it's a short term bump. Boop, little boop. And then it'll go once those people who were impacted by that marketing, by those impressions, will either buy or not buy, and then it's over. And then it's old news. So I think you might see a small impact. Do you agree? Does that kind of...
I do agree. And I guess all I would say to that is if you're trying to develop a theory of why it happens, if indeed it does happen, I think it's important to understand that it may be irrational. And if you get caught in it, you may find yourself in a very short order on the wrong side of it. Yes.
Right.
And if so you again,
on this side, you come in on this side, it's probably going to go that way after it goes back to the normal state of affairs.
That's right. So again, doing your research, understanding your limits, make sure that you've done what you need to do to get comfortable. Once you've done that, pull the trigger. If you're able to, and listen, you don't have to listen to me if you don't want to. That's fine, right? Here's what I know. There were hundreds and hundreds of cardboard millionaires back in 2020, and those guys are still wearing the same ratty clothes and looking and showing up every week at all these shows. And I mean, let's be honest. Jeremy, if I somehow made $5 or $6 million off of buying and selling cards over the next couple of years, I can tell you one thing: you're not going to see me at as many shows.
Right? No, that's a lot of money for sure. And you're exactly right on all that. I want to go to a couple comments here really quickly. First, Sean says, "I was the guy with a birthday card for my mom made from a Gretzky rookie card cut up when I was 12. Also gave you the Shane." Don't, Sean, now I completely remember. Thank you for letting me know. And your birthday card I put on Instagram got a great response, by the way.
I want him to slab it, right? I told you, would they slab it authentic? And Jeremy was like, who cares? And I was like, I don't know. I think it'd be pretty cool. Yeah.
I think it was one of the coolest things I saw at Expo. And then Sean actually gifted me this handful of Shane Doan rookie cards. Sean, thank you so much. I thank you for that. And I'm glad I now know who you are. So again, thank you for being here and congratulations. A vintage card collector says, I don't agree with the lazy comment, David. If this was everyone's full-time job, it would be true. But for most, it's called a hobby for a reason. So I just want to give you an opportunity to address that comment and maybe try and find some common ground if you can.
I don't agree with that. I don't believe, first of all, the premise that it was everybody's full-time job. It's not. Less than 1% of the people in the hobby are doing this as a full-time job. It's actually probably even infinitesimal smaller than 1%. So it's a fallacy to even start from that discussion. I think everybody's going to get out of the hobby what they put into it. And I believe that 100%. The people who get more out of it are the people that are spending more time. They're being more efficient with the time that they spend. And look, there's an element of people that don't want to do all that. And they're going to buy things that they enjoy, and that's okay. And I'm going to still describe that somewhat as lazy, because I think that it puts them in situations where they're not able to be as efficient with the dollars that they devote to the hobby as they could be if they would increase their time spent and not in their learning process by just a little bit. I really don't think it takes a lot to become quite a bit more informed if it is you sort of know what you're after. And that's tough. And listen, Jeremy is somebody that, like, I collect everything, right? I've said that. I'm a compulsive purchaser across all kinds of different segments, right? But I do it very intentionally. And again, I try to make sure I know what I'm doing so that I can't, because I'm buying all this stuff, I need to be pretty efficient with how I bring things in and things that aren't necessarily in the collection that are more there to be, you know, sold for a profit to help me offset the costs of the things that I'm keeping. And then even now, as I'm trying to run a business, like, I mean, the reality is if I don't sell, I'm going to go bankrupt, and I don't really want to do that. So I need to be on top of that stuff, which requires more time and effort. So, you know, but look, I 100% get it. People don't like being called lazy. And I'll say, if that really turns you off and you haven't seen my other videos to hear me talk about it and laugh about it and point the fingers of being lazy right back at me, then get familiar with the unfollow button and go follow somebody else that makes you feel better. Right? There's lots of choices out there. I'm here to share my journey, and I'd like to make friends. And if that's not your style, that's cool. There are other people to go out there and follow.
And there you have it.
Is that too mean?
What's that?
Is that too mean?
I mean, no, listen, you're being mean.
It might be stupid if I cared about how many followers I had. So again, guilty. Here I am.
No, I mean, listen, you do you. I mean, what else can I say? Is it mean? I don't know. I mean, listen, I'm a big proponent of curating your hobby experience, you know, your collection, also curate your experience. Yes. The unfollow button is a wonderful thing. The block button is a wonderful thing. I've unfollowed some accounts that I've followed for years. Why? Because they don't enhance my life. Yes.
Yeah.
If David isn't enhancing your life, or if I'm not enhancing your life, you know, and if someone is not enhancing my life, I'm at the age and stage of life now where I don't have time or energy. Right. I'm not looking for conflict.
Just take a break, right? It's okay. Yeah. Like I do that too. Sometimes I'll just take a break from people. I mean, I say all the time, there are a lot of people I follow, even Jeremy, that I don't necessarily like, but they sometimes say some things that help me go through that curation exercise, even if it's me curating from them what not to do. Because sometimes not doing something is even more important than actually doing something. And so, you know, but I also think it's important to try to get into the totality. And you mentioned it, right? A lot of times when I talk about these two hobby truths, I'm doing it in my YouTube videos and that kind of stuff and some of my older content. So, it, you know, it's out there, but, you know, if people really like kind of the shorter segments, it's sometimes hard to get into that depth, and that's okay. I'm still learning this whole content game anyway. You know, you and I are about the same age. I don't know about you. I was never really comfortable with it. I'm still not sure. And I'm definitely not very technologically good with any of it. So like that's out there too. My stuff tends to be pretty kitschy and simple, but that it's all right. It works for me so far, in that I'm really mostly doing it to, you know, talk about the things that I do and try to share my knowledge as best I can. And if for some it hits and others it doesn't, that's cool.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've become a lot more comfortable with it. I'm, you know, coming up on 4 years doing this. So I used to get butterflies in my stomach before I'd go live. That lasted first maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 times I did it. And now here I am. I'm almost at 500 live streams. And I don't, I
let it rip.
What's that?
You just let it rip.
Yeah, no, I don't, there's no nerves anymore at all for me. That went away a while ago, but I'm just, it's routine. It's part of what's, anyway, let's keep on moving. Couple comments. 1956 Tops Guy Matthew says, veteran collectors like these guys are really important for educating newbies so they don't get taken advantage of. Being nice can help make the pill easier to swallow. Well said. Irish Flyers, Neil, what a nice, Jeremy enriches my hobby. You enrich mine, Neil. You enrich my hobby experience. I'm not just saying that, you really do. Meeting Neil at the expo was a wonderful benefit or bonus for me at the show. And Vintage Response says, there are lazy people in every industry. Some NBA players are clearly lazy, but we don't say NBA players are lazy. Broad generalizations are themselves lazy comments. I think I think you'd fair. Accept. That's fair, right? That's fair.
Listen, I never said that I wasn't guilty of violating both my hobby truths.
Right.
I'm just making everybody aware that they exist.
It's partially why you know they exist, because you
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
We got about 10 minutes left. We're going to do one more topic here, David. And I want to talk about, because you've talked to me and made me, this has influenced my thoughts a bit about, you know, thinking, where does the hobby really live, right? We see, like you mentioned before, we see record-breaking sales all the time. I get the daily card ladder email that shows 3 records. I got to tell you, I like seeing that there are still records being broken, even in the ups and downs in the hobby. I like seeing that. But we see a lot of these glorifieds. I do my Sunday night, or sorry, my PWCC premiere show one Thursday a month with Adam Gray. Every card we're looking at is basically, they should be 10 grand or more. Many of them are 100,000. Like, these are out of the reach of all but a minuscule amount of people in the hobby. It's fun to watch, but it's out of our reach. Like, you know, just like watching Baywatch, it's out of our most of our reach, you know, but lot of us watch that stuff anyway, or did back in the day. Talk about what you mean when, like, where does the hobby really live to you? What have you learned? What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, so part of this comes from my experience having set up at shows and even having owned a store a long time ago, even though, you know, times have changed in terms of some of the pricing and stuff. But from setting up the shows for the last really 7-8 years, and then also had a great conversation actually with Chris from Card Ladder about this while I was up in Dallas. So I've always said that the overwhelming majority, I actually think it's probably 98% or more, but some people would call it only 95. But to say it's an overwhelming majority of the cards in the hobby and collectors in the hobby are operating in the under $100 space. So they're not even in 3 figures, much less 5 or 6 figures. And when you move from about $100 to $500, the pool of buyers narrows probably in half, because listen, the reality is $500 is still a lot of money to most people. It's a housing payment. It's a car payment. It's a tuition payment. It's lots of different things. Right. And then once you get to 1,000, you really start to narrow the gap. Now, most hobbyists over time, especially those that are kind of aspirational, let's say, they can often and will often eventually sort of get to that level. But I mean, I remember for me, the first time I paid $1,000 for something I was really uncomfortable with it and probably wasn't ready when I did that. But when you then move from 1,000 to 10,000, forget it. You are down to a very, very small group of collectors / speculators that operate in that space. And so, you know, as I described to you, when you look around at the shows and see some of the most active tables, it's always the value bins, right? The bargain bucket stuff, the $10, $5, $1, you know, 5,000 count boxes that are stuffed with stuff. I mean, people will just absolutely wear those things out.
Your guy hit him high, Josh at the Toronto.
Yes.
He's got racks of these things, and that's the bread and butter.
Yes, and I mean, he, you know, the people that are doing that probably have to go home and put Band-Aids on the blisters. But I mean, the reality is there are cool cards in there. There are valuable cards in there. There are one of the kids that I know down here in Houston, Jacob, Ball Cards in the Attic. He will wear these things out. And I mean, he inevitably always walks away with a couple, 2 or 3 cards that are, you know, $50, $100, $150 comp that he scored out of some $5 bin. I mean, it happens. That stuff's out there. And it should, listen, it's just a different way to kind of approach your collecting. But that is where the core of the hobby really lives. And what something, and so to give a little light on, if I've remembered this correctly, what Chris told me, and I really hope Card Ladder would like, and some of the other pricing people would share some of this information just so that we all kind of know. But I think what Chris told me was that the average sale price of cards in any given month ended up being around about $100 a card. But he said, and that was the average, but he said the median price was actually less than, I think he said, $70. And you know, that's from all the online data and other stuff that they pull from all the auction houses. And then, like, I think you and I talked about, listen, if we scoped out the top 20% or even just the top 10% of card sales from that data, what happens to that $70? Does it actually drop to like 20? And to me, that hearing that from him really validated my experience, what I see with my eyes, but also just experienced as I was continuing and still do continue to build out my collection and things that I buy. The real heart and soul of the hobby is in that under $100 range. And you know, my challenge to people is to don't try not to get caught up with the social media highlight reel of the records, and listen, challenge the people that are only showing you those highlights to either show you their real PC and talk about why it's cool without talking about the value, because I think there are a lot of people out there that can't really do that. And then secondly, challenge them, if you don't see cards that are under $100 on their timeline, challenge them to find one and tell you why it's cool. You know, Jeremy, you and I have talked about, I'm pursuing the stained glass sets for Allen and Ginter in 2019 and 2020. And when I showed those on my page, you came back to me and said, you know, there's some stained glasses that I like too. And right, my immediate reply was Topps Gallery of Heroes is pretty awesome. And like, boom, pictures of Topps Gallery of Heroes cards come into my DMs from you. And like, they're not expensive cards, but they're wonderful design. They're aesthetically pleasing. They, you know, you said you had one in your window. There's just a lot of other stuff like that, as well as even, you know, things like.
Here it is.
That, yeah,
it's the oversized one.
The oversized
that I like bought by accident on Tom C.
Yes,
but this like just to give you the how big it's. You know, that's a that's how oversized it is from a regular card. And I'm like, I'm not going to send this back. And I have it sitting on a stand in my window. So when light shines through, this thing's beautiful.
And like, so, you know, when you mentioned earlier the curation bit.
$15.
I still believe that it's so important as a collector to still find ways that to be able to find cards that you enjoy. And I talked about this not long ago on my story. Cards that don't have a link necessarily into price, that it's something that you're able to measure from the kind of the joy of sharing it and telling the story about it with somebody else and actually allowing their reaction to that to be the thing that brings value to that card, right? I think if you can do that, You really are now into the curation aspect of what you're trying to do as a collector. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not a place for investing and speculating. There 100% is. But we've just been inundated with that type of content. And I was one of the people back in 2020 that was railing on this stuff and saying it's too much, it's too much, it's too much. It's the wrong focus. The dollar value is not, if the dollar value is the first thing that comes to your mind when you're looking at a card, I don't consider that being a collector. I consider that being an investor and a speculator, which is different. And so for collectors, if you want to be a collector, you've got to be careful how you take that stuff in and let it impact how you make your collecting decisions. And so, you know, I encourage people, try to find some low dollar value stuff that's fun to collect. I love the Topps Chrome parallels. So like with Mookie and Altuve and Bregman and guys like that, I've got my binder sheet with like 9 chrome sepias in there. And I just love them. Like I can look at those, you know, and still experience the design and the product and still get the, you know, that joy of just seeing the poses and of the players that I enjoy watching and that I want to, you know, that I connect with for whatever reason. So,
I mean, just listening to you speak about this. I mean, if you're listening, those of us listening to you right now, it's like, yeah, there's something to be said for, it doesn't have to be, every card doesn't have to be, you don't have to derive value because they're worth so much money. There is joy in $5 cards.
Yeah.
Maybe there's joy in 25-cent cards to a lot of people. It just depends what the card is. There is joy in all cards along the whole scope, right up to the big ones too. But don't discount the joy that we as hobbyists can gain from cheaper cards that fill a binder. You know, it's like you said to me, I like to say, look what I collect. I got, you know, like it's just funny how that works. And I think also that we are often sort of, we're misled by the amount of high value cards we see on social media. It all depends on how you've curated your social media experience. Yeah. If you're on Instagram and everyone you're following is showing, you know, $1,000 cards all the time, that's what you might think the norm is. But what David is trying to tell us is that it isn't. Data states that the average card in the hobby sells for about $70 as for what Card Ladder tracks. However, I said, yeah, but take out all the $100,000 plus cards. That 70 probably comes down to way down, right? Take out everything over 10, everything 10,000 up. That probably comes down to $15.
Yeah,
I mean, we're guessing here, but yes. I think that makes sense. Matt W. wants to know, does David have a podcast? David, I don't think you do.
I keep getting requests. Adam has been pushing me to do it. And going back to Hobby Truth, number one, I'm lazy and it's still not convinced myself that I'm going to do it. But I'm seriously considering it. And if I do, I will absolutely let everybody know. And I'm sure guys, you know, my friends like Jeremy and Adam and others will tell you guys about it too. So,
and check out David's Instagram handle is right under his name. They're at Signed in Slab. So if you want to see when he does launch a podcast, make sure you're following him on Instagram. Mark Santucci said, nice card to my Cal Ripken Jr. Oversized Gallery of Heroes. Thank you, Mark. 1956 Topps guy, Matthew, finding inexpensive cards that deliver the engagement and feels are the best. That is the hobby. Yeah, that's what it's like. I gotta tell you, I love the joy I feel from a cheaper, more inexpensive card. It's, why do I love it? Because it's the same joy I feel from an expensive card. Literally, correct. It's the same feeling. It might even be better because I don't have as much at risk or as much invested. I can, you know, but I also love my expensive cards too. I buy very expensive cards and I do love them, but the joy is pretty much the same from a lower end card. Zach Swisher says, as someone who rejoined the hobby during COVID, it's definitely hard not to think price. I understand that, but there are lower price cards that you can enjoy. I would think, Zach, you just have to look for them and you know, just you'll come across them. Sean Red says, I have a wall of 80s OPG ungraded hockey cards that I love. Very cool. Matthew says, we need to do better as a community of highlighting great collector accounts that aren't ours. And Matthew does a great job of always sharing other people's cards to his story on Instagram, and it is at 1956 Topps guy. If you're not following Matthew on Instagram yet, highly recommend his account right there. Mark says, does David like newer cards, 4 or 5 for 15? Aaron Judge, 23 is one of them. Anything to respond to that?
Listen, I buy Mookie Betts Chrome Parallels 5 for $5 on ComC. So like, and sometimes cheaper. You just get out there and dig, man. I got to have a refractor every year that a new set comes out. And as long as I wait past about 2 weeks, I can score Mookie for about 48 cents.
Yeah, there you go. Matt W., great job of the show. Thank you, Matt W. All right, David, 2 hours and five. We've been in overtime for 5 minutes. We're at the 2-hour 5 mark of this show. This went by super fast for me. So thank you for joining me tonight. We did not get through every topic we wanted to, but that is okay. We will We will regroup later and do this again in the future. But I want to thank you for coming on, sharing your thoughts on everything. The chat, you guys were really great tonight. I say that pretty much all the time, but you know, we had some sensitive topics earlier, and you know, I just want to thank everybody for being respectful throughout the episode. Thank you to the chat for being just being the way you almost pretty much always are. If you want to get any final comments into the chat, please get them in right away, because we're going to end this in about a minute. David, final comments over to you before we end this thing.
I appreciate you having me on. I had a ball. I do want to also sort of say publicly, I did get to experience some of the level that goes into planning these things to make sure they kind of run off without a hitch. And not everybody puts that effort in. I personally was very appreciative of that from you, Jeremy, because I know how hard these things are to do with even the little bit of content that I do. And I don't really do a lot of live. So again, for those of you out there who think this is easy, sometimes the preparation is what really makes it look a lot easier than it is. And Jeremy puts a lot of effort into that. So I appreciate you for dragging me along in that, because you did not allow me to get into the hobby is lazy component of prep for the show. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, David. Thank you again for your contribution to Sports Cards Live episode number 204. 1956 Doc Tops Guy says, yeah, this has been really fab. Thank you, Matthew. Mark Santucci, appreciate that 5 out of 5 stars. Mike, appreciate you as always. Hobby Champs, peace out. Much appreciated. Matt says, yeah, Matt's been on. I forget your episode number, Matt, but Matthew, but thank you for joining the show tonight. Irish Flyers, Megabit and Accountability. LGC, thank you so much. Currency Project, thank you so much. Great comment. Hobby Champs, thank you. Have a good Thanksgiving, you lazy it is. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We'll be back again on the channel tomorrow for the PWCC Weekly Hockey, Monday for MC Mondays Live, and again next Saturday with the giveaway from Leighton Sheldon on a graded vintage card. And our guest will be Brian Wells, the founder of Ship My Cards. We'll hear about his hobby history and a bit about running his business in the hobby. With that, everybody, thanks again. Have a great rest of your weekend. This episode of Sports Cards Live is now over.